Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
Hello.
Hello, is this Daniel of Shalimov?
Yes, it is.
Hi, it's Jill Pasternak at WRTI in Philadelphia.
Jill, yes, I was looking forward to your call.
Yes, we're running just a few minutes late. Sorry about that. But in any case, welcome to Crossover.
Thank you. A pleasure to speak with you and to be looking forward to the performance we're going to give.
You will be performing here in Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center on October 27th.
Mm-hmm.
What works are you going to be doing?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and it's topical because our original program got changed. We were going to have performed Stabat Mater by Boccherini, and the singer who is identified with that piece, with whom we intend to perform it in the future, unfortunately had to cancel. She was coming from Europe, and her schedule got changed. So we're going to do a somewhat more straightforward program this time and postpone the Boccherini for a later event. We're going to be doing a Haydn, I believe, Ravel Quartet, and the Schubert Cello Quintet with our dear friend Andres Diaz.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, and I love the Ravel, especially. It's just absolutely marvelous work.
Yeah.
Now, of course, that is kind of what you do, but you also have a reputation for doing some of the more contemporary works. Well, they're not actually as contemporary as we might think. Alban Berg certainly isn't, and Anton Webern isn't that contemporary, but in terms of music and the audience, that is the way it's categorized. You have come out with a wonderful album as well with the Schubert Quartet and the Berg and Webern. So can we talk a little bit about that and talk a little bit about the quartet, which is, I can't believe it, 35 years old? Is that the
That's the hard truth. We all feel so young, but there it is. The years have been adding up. Yeah, the CD that we just came out with is kind of a statement about not only music that we care deeply about and feel we have something to say with, but to speak very candidly, the Second Viennese School, Schoenberg, Berg, Webern, is the point at which a lot of listeners stumble. They either see the name and have an association with a piece that they didn't like or didn't understand, or maybe haven't even really heard any of it, but know that that's where the trouble starts in the continuum of music.
Right.
And so we set out to see what we could do, not so much to remedy that, but to bring a different kind of focus to that period. Because, in fact, all those composers, for whatever they did that was new, didn't just spring forth
nowhere.
Zeus's brow, right, or from nowhere is probably better. They grew up with the same influences that we all had, all the music that came before, which they either preferred or didn't, but learned from and reacted to. And so by putting these three pieces together on a CD, Schubert's final quartet, the Quartet in G, the Berg Opus 3, his first quartet, and the Webern Five Movements, we are hoping that when people listen to those works in the context of each other, that they will begin to hear the influences on the later composers, which they absorbed from Schubert.
What are the exact dates of Berg and Webern in terms of when they started actually composing?
Well, let's see. They were composing before the turn of the century. I think that century, that is to say, Berg's Quartet Opus 3, I think, is from 1910 or 1908. Yeah, both right around the beginning of the 1900s.
Well, that was when it all started to change. I mean, certainly Stravinsky was doing his thing as well.
Sure, and Bartok was emerging at that time. So there was plenty of newness. But the reason that the Schubert is such an influence is that Schubert really was not known in his day for anything other than the songs that he wrote. Hundreds and hundreds of songs, all wonderful. But piles, shall we say, of chamber works and symphonic works and operas. He wrote 16 operas that are completely unknown. Were simply not known in his lifetime and not celebrated, examined, or performed even after his death. So you might say that his influence was lying in wait for about a generation. Everybody knew about Beethoven, of course. But Schubert emerged later, was sort of rediscovered by the Mahler, Bruckner, Schoenberg, Berg, Webern.
It's interesting you say that, because I think there's a lot of that going on now in terms of Schubert.
I think
there all of a sudden here is this great talent, and we are really appreciating it much more now.
Yeah.
which is rather unusual. But of course, I guess it takes how many years before one is appreciated.
Well, and it would have been hard. It would have been hard to be a composer, good, bad, or indifferent in Beethoven's lifetime. You know, the influence that Beethoven was having while he was alive and immediately after his death was just incalculable.
Yes.
So that's the explanation. But in a way, it's kind of a nice reward for us now that we can continue to absorb all these fine source influences.
Well, you know, when you're working as a musician on works to perform or just to learning them, I think it comes to you as you are studying the work. What happened, the evolution of how this we arrived at this point. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also quite an awakening for you as a musician, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because however much we study, however carefully we prepare, however deep our instincts are about music, there comes in every composer's output a point at which we as performers say, I'm not quite sure I understand what's going on here. And there's no shame in that. You need to admit it as soon as you recognize that it's so. Because then the process of learning the music changes. It has to do with finding out more about what was going on at the time and at the place where the music was written. What was going on in the composer's life? What was going on? What other works was he composing, say, not just for string quartet, although that's all we really think about.
Yeah.
I find it so instructive to look at the symphonies or the piano sonatas or any of the other music that was being written by any composer at the point around which we're trying to get to know a string quartet better.
And you get your aha moment, as they say, I guess.
Well, as often as we can, yes. Yeah, there's some places, there's some things that we still wrestle with, but there's a pleasure in that, too.
Now, I'm going to ask you a burning question,
yeah.
And I'm not condescending, but viola.
Yes.
The poor viola,
yes.
Very beautiful, wonderful instrument that is kind of like a second trombone.
Yes.
I don't know what what have you struggled with that, not within the quartet scene,
no.
But as a violist?
I find it no struggle. As a matter of fact, I not only tell viola jokes, I encourage them. I think until the standard of viola playing has risen to the point that the average violist is considered to be as competent, say, as the average violinist or pianist or anything else, that the jokes probably should be allowed to continue. It has a little bit to do with how the instrument was written for initially.
Mm-hmm.
It also had to do with the people who played it. Occasionally someone who was not quite as agile as the one who wound up with a violin in his hands would be handed a viola and said, look, you have fewer notes to play. Have a good time. Here's your viola. But it's a kind of a chicken and egg thing, because if you assume that it's a lesser technique and you're a composer, then you don't write demanding parts for it. If you're the player and you have less demanding parts, you see how it becomes circular. The other explanation, of course, has to do with acoustic physics, and this is a rather long sermon, so I'll make an abridgment.
Yes.
But the proportions of the violin have not changed in hundreds of years simply because they are exactly the way they're supposed to be. And the sound that the strings produce is reinforced by the vibration of the amount of air that the body of the instrument holds.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially very old-fashioned amplifier. The cello, too, although they vary in size and shape somewhat, proportionally, the greatest cellos are within the same range of size as all the great violins are to each other. For the viola to have the same natural reinforcement as the violin and cello do for the string length that they have, they would have to be physically such large objects that no one could play them. So every viola maker has been trying to skirt the laws of physics by making them not so long but much wider, or very thick, or having wide hips but narrower shoulders, and each viola is kind of an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, none of them has succeeded so well that we are blessed with thousands of viola concertos, which is to say that's the measure of projection, I would say. If a composer thinks an instrument can be heard above the fray, then he'll write a concerto for it.
Okay.
If he's not sure about that, then he will write chamber music for it.
But aren't you lucky?
I certainly am. I think playing in a quartet is absolutely the best employment for a violist, the best one could hope.
And even if you have a great instrument, say like an Amati, and is it true that you have one?
Yes, I'm a happy person.
Oh, you are. What? How? When? Where? When did you get it?
I got it in 1986.
And what year is it?
It's from 1568.
My goodness.
Yeah.
How does that feel,
Andrea? Oh, it's It's thrilling. I have to say, I smile every single time I open up the case and see it there waiting for me.
But that's, I mean, people usually are given them to play, aren't they? And you acquired it, is that right?
I did, yeah. It was owned by the assistant principal in the Cleveland Orchestra, and he had an agreement with his wife, and I bless his name every time I tell this story, because their deal was that when he died, she was, of course, going to sell it. She didn't need it and wasn't a player, but she would only sell it to another player, not to a dealer, not to a gallery, not to a collector, even though she could have made, I think, a lot more money by considering those openings.
Yeah.
And at that time, the principal cellist in Cleveland was the older brother of our founding cellist, David Gaber. And Stephen Gaber called me up and said, you know, this instrument's coming on the market. And I was playing a modern viola at the time, and I had a long rant about how I wasn't going to succumb to old instrumentitis. In fact, there weren't very many old violas that were worth playing, and of those, not very many were healthy. And of those, the prices were so extraordinary that the hope of modern viola playing is in modern violas, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he said, look, I'm not trying to sell you the viola. I've sat next to it for years. I think it sounds great. And when it comes to New York, you ought to just put your fingers on it for the experience. I said, oh, well, I can do that. So I went down to where it was being shown, and I put my fingers on it, and I was simultaneously exhilarated and scared out of my mind.
It made you sound terrific, I guess.
Because I knew I had to have it. Well, the thing is, I mean, back to my sermon about acoustic physics, each viola sounds so different from the next, and you carry inside yourself this idea or ideal of what a viola ought to sound like, and I picked this up, and it sounded just the way I always thought a viola should sound.
Well, I think in many cases too, it's the how the sound carries with the viola. It doesn't pierce through like a violin. I was going to ask you how you all agree at interpretation and, you know, all of the things that are inherent to performance. Do you discuss things?
Well, we discuss everything. Yeah. We argue about things. We agree about things. Actually, some of the richest experiences are not the instant accords, but the long drawn out processes by which we examine not only what we think the composer's trying to tell us, but what we want to make of it. And in that process, we learn how our colleagues reason, we learn how our colleagues feel, we learn how our colleagues debate. And in the end, all the good ideas that we come up with belong to the whole group. And any of the ideas that become eliminated or shouted down are no one's property, really. That's the best thing about a quartet. It's probably the last functioning democracy.
I was going to say it's international harmony, I guess.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean it's all sweetness and light. We do fight, and we've learned over the years how to fight productively and fairly so that we can disagree. I mean, another great advantage, particularly with a quartet that plays a lot of concerts, is we have many performances of a work. So if we've hammered it down to maybe two or three ways that a movement could be played, we have the luxury of performing it different ways, different nights, until by the end of the season we've either achieved some consensus or we've combined the ideas or we've come up with something brand new. And that's another far-ranging sort of process, which is a joy for us.
Now, you have distinguished members, Peter Winograd, violinist and son of the renowned cellist of the Juilliard String Quartet, Arthur Winograd. And Daniel, of course, that's you and your father, a distinguished composer, Laurie Carney, violinist.
And her whole family is and was filled with musicians. She has three siblings, all violinists.
And Wolfram Kessel?
Kessel, yes. Well, he's the standout. He's the only professional musician in his family. But I have a feeling maybe the dynasty is beginning. His little daughter, who is a little more than one, gets a great deal of pleasure out of the piano keyboard.
Well, you can't escape it, I guess.
No, no.
We always say it's not really a very good profession, but all of our children get involved in it somehow or other.
That's right.
So this is, again, your 35th anniversary season. You have a rather heavy schedule, don't you, for the year?
Well, we do, yeah. The fall has started off in a very, very, what's the word I want?
Pleasant?
Well, pleasant and also, I was going to say, merciful way, because for the first month, all our concerts are things we can either drive to or, in my case, even take a bus to. We have several things in New York and things up and down the East Coast.
Of course, you have some stuff in Israel as well.
Yeah, that's right. Then flying begins. We have a tour of Israel. We get back from that. We have a couple concerts in the States, and then we leave for Europe on another tour there.
Very exciting, very exciting. Now, so this new release on Nadja Salerno Sonnenberg's label is quite beautiful, and she's all excited about you. And I think coming from her, it is a tremendous honor, you know, to be recorded and highlighted this way. Because
we're very pleased. You know, both Laurie and I were in school with Nadja, and Peter knows her well. Both Nadja, Laurie, and Peter all studied with Dorothy DeLay, so they have in common there.
Yes.
And when we decided what we wanted to put on this album, we were enjoying the freedom from the major label syndrome, which is to say, oh, American Quartet, won't you please record Barbara Copeland's whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Not that we have anything against doing that, but at this point, these were the works that we wanted to get out.
Well, the word American, you know, that's...
People assume.
Right, but that you don't know any of the European literature. Well, that's, of course, that they don't assume it, but they figure that's the way they'll sell it.
Right.
But considering the state of the music business and of what's going on, and we do all feel it in various ways.
Sure.
You have a full schedule and a demanding one and a promising, recording discography that you have put together. How many recordings have you made so far? This is the first with Nadja, is that
this
right?
This is the first with Nadja. We are hoping there'll be many more, and she was very gracious about her willingness to take this on, because we were basically saying, here's what we want to do, here's how we want to do it. And not that we were belligerent in any way, but we just had all these dealings with major labels in the past where we hadn't had that kind of freedom. And she said, of course, you should be doing exactly what you want. Tell me how I can help and tell me when to keep out of the way. So it's been a dream relationship.
I was going to say, isn't it wonderful to deal with someone who knows what's going on as a musician?
Well, and she's found out the hard way just as we.
Oh, yes, of course.
With her past recordings. But to answer the first part of your question, let me think. We've recorded all the Mozart quartets. We've done a handful of American works, mostly things that we've commissioned. Works by Kenneth Fuchs, by Richard Daniel Poor.
Yes.
By Klaus Adam. We've recorded Prokofiev's. We've recorded Dvorak's.
Now, are these available? What label are these on?
Oh, a great mix. Let's see. The Mozarts have just been re-released by Nimbus.
Oh, Records. That's an excellent label, yeah.
And they got the rights from Music Masters, Musical Heritage, who were the original issuers of the complete Mozart. So we're delighted that they're back out, just purely coincidentally in time for our anniversary, but there it is. The Dvorak's have been re-released also, and I should be embarrassed to say I don't know on what label, but I'm not embarrassed because these things are so fluid. I think the simplest way to track down the Dvorak's or our Prokofiev's or our Schoenberg Quartet Concerto would be to go to something like Amazon.
But now, what about new recordings? This is the new recording, is that right?
The Schubert's Echo is the newest, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about because, of course, you have a discography that reaches back quite a while, and you as musicians have evolved since then as well.
Of course,
so it's kind of interesting always to compare. Maybe you have to revisit some of the things you did and say, wait a minute, we should play it this way instead.
Oh, I'm instantly willing to plead guilty to that. As a matter of fact, I sometimes stay away from our recordings.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Because you become, I have always said as a soloist, you become a different person as you grow.
I mean,
if we didn't, that would be very sad. But as a quartet, certainly you evolve and you also get to know each other so very well. So it's exciting to speak with you, Daniel. I hope to see you on October 27th here at the Kimmel Center with the American String Quartet and look forward to your new recordings. And thanks so much for visiting us here at WRTI.
Thank you so much for your wonderful questions. I look forward to seeing you.